This is a Renewed Covenant Ministry message. Every message delivered by this ministry strives to show the relevance of the most important covenant ever revealed to God's people, the New Covenant, a covenant offering grace through faith, thereby renewing the law of God in our hearts and minds through the manifestation of the only begotten Son and eternal Word of God, in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the Son of God and Son of Man, the firstborn among many brethren. The majority of our audio messages come from our Sabbath Bible studies, delivered by Brother J.S. Lowther at a Sabbath convocation centered around the patriarchal family structure near Marietta, Ohio. Contact us by mail at Box 134, 140 Gross Street, Marietta, Ohio, 45750. Find related messages relevant to the systematic theology offered by Renewed Covenant Ministry at renewedcovenantministry.com. And now for the message.
This is going to be the third part of a series on church government. We will specifically be looking at the relationship between a country and a nation as we move into understanding the place of eldership and the presbytery of a particular people. So that's kind of the direction we're going to be going in. Exodus chapter 20, verse 12 from the Ten Commandments of God says, "Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee." So when we begin to venture outside of the simplicity of the meaning of father and mother as one's direct forebears, your actual father and mother, that is, your literal father who begat you, and your mother who bore you, we then start to see verses like Leviticus 19, verse 32, which we had already looked at also in this study, which says, "Thou shalt rise up before the hoary head and honor the face of the old man," or the presbyter, "and fear thy God. I am Yahweh, I am the Lord." And so, again, a presbyter is literally an elderly person, an older person, and quite frankly means old one. That's the meaning of the word. It's not very glorious terminology, but that is exactly what the meaning of the word indicates, both in the Septuagint and in the New Testament Greek scriptures. So these verses are noticed because it commands honor to elders, old men and old women, but particularly focusing on the old men that would rule, as I will continue to refer to as presbyters and in a presbytery. As we see this commandment, the fifth commandment, kind of moving on in its direction. So when we see that the command of honor or value towards immediate father and mother being the focus, it should be recognized that it's losing no impact of force by an additional context. So by us understanding the elder men and elder women as being part of the fifth commandment in the construct of it, it doesn't lose impact. So we don't give away the honor to father and mother to someone else. Rather, we see within it a combined understanding. We see a revealing of that meaning extending out further into the nation or into the borders of a country, which we're going to focus on more as we go on and lay the foundation for that. Rather, it's well sustainable that the term father and mother are biblically inclusive of one's parentage in general. For instance, in Exodus chapter 3, which we'll be spending quite a bit of time in this study, we hear scriptures that say, Exodus 3, verse 6, "He said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God." And notice the terminology. Moses' direct father was not Abraham. Moses' direct father was not Isaac or Jacob. That was grandparents of his. Those were his ancestral fathers. And so we can very easily conclude that the honor of one's father and the understanding of a biblical father goes back beyond one's immediate father and mother. So here we see that Moses' father is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, though we would say those were his grandparents in our common speak, or of his great-grandfathers. But in Hebrew scriptures, these two are considered fathers. So we definitely have a firm basis to understand it from that angle. And because we can understand that, then we know that they deserve honor or value, esteem, as we have already laid the ground for, that the type of value that one values in their parentage is the same type of value that you would value in weighing out something that is valuable to you, such as precious metal or flour, salt, meat, all the things that we used as our example a few Bible studies ago. And so that same value of purity and value of substance of what it is in focus all the more. In this way, we know that fathers and mothers of the fifth commandment are more than just one's immediate progenitors. So in all ways, the government of Israel, as it's outlined, is sustained according to the family prerogative, I would call it. It is sustained in the family prerogative. And that is that, you know, regardless of if we're talking about the Christian family or if we're talking about the tribal family or the national family, we're talking about a family prerogative, those who are concerned with the function and the life and the goodwill and the commonwealth of the family and of their people. And so the order of inheritance is then where your mind definitely goes when we speak of the family prerogative. The order of inheritance is intrinsically linked to the family structure. So much so that when you read the Bible, specifically in Genesis and other places in God's law, but Genesis is where it's seen the most, the right of the firstborn as it pertains to inheritance is the same as it pertains to government within a family structure. Okay, when you see Abraham giving his inheritance to Isaac and Isaac to Jacob instead of Esau, and then we see the way that the 12 tribes have certain things divvied up between them, and then Joseph and Judah have rights of firstborn given to them, firstborns taken away from Reuben, who was the true firstborn because he was godless, and it was he acted in a godless manner, and so his father redacted the firstborn status and gave it to Levi. And so we see a way that God distributes this and then blesses through Moses and through Jacob the children of Israel in specific ways as it pertains to inheritance. But whenever you talk about the firstborn, and we talk about one who that was firstborn within the family structure, we also see a link in the connection on how it relates to the government of the people of Israel and how the people were governed. An easy way to see this would be in the lines of the priests, whereas the high priest's son, when he came into, it says, his father's stead, then he was made priest in the place of his father. And so we very much see the same concept of inheritance being passed on in a preference or a preferred order of how things work. And so it's, I think, important to notice that first. We'll get into it a little bit more at the end of the study. But notice that in inheritance, and then as we talk about inheriting a country or inheriting parts of a country, land and things like that, as it was understood to the people of Israel, as they would have understood the fifth commandment, that within the honor of one's father and mother, inheritance is then implied within the biblical commonwealth. It's guided by the verbiage, by the way the fifth commandment ends in its ending clause. As it said in Exodus 20:12, that thou mayest live long on the good land, or on the land, the earth, which Yahweh your God giveth thee. And so in many ways, we have the idea of inheritance of land, or the inheritance of the country, of the people, from the honor that is given to father and mother also. And that's important to notice, because as we understand how God was establishing Israel to be a people with their own country, their own land as a kingdom, then we also have to see how that inheritance was passed on, not only in a genetic way from father to son, giving a certain son his right to rule as the right of the firstborn, as we see with Christ, for instance, who is the ultimate firstborn, the one seed that was destined to come. we see that that is an inheritance that's given to him, a promise and a covenant that's given. But also when it comes to land and how that people interact with the country they live in, then it carries inheritance into a whole understanding of a national inhabitation, you know, a place where they inhabit to call theirs. And so it creates an intrinsic tie within the Commonwealth, and it's intended to do so, to tie land to the value or honor of one's parentage in the Fifth Commandment, insomuch that one who values his parents values his inheritance and vice versa. So it's important on account of a modern misconception that we have that a nation is not a direct replacement or synonym for the word country. This is very much a misconception, and it's a wrong understanding of the words that we use, that a nation is not a replacement or synonym for the word country. They're two completely different concepts. They're tied, intrinsically tied together, but a nation is not the same as a country. You have to keep that in mind whenever you're thinking about law, whenever you're thinking about God's law and how it speaks, because if you confuse those understandings, all of a sudden the borders of a land become a nation. It's not true. It's not how it actually works. And a nation does not become a country. You can be a nation without a homeland, okay? A nation has to do with who you are, your people. A country has to do with where you live, the ground under your feet. But the Fifth Commandment deals with both. And it's important to remember that. Because in the Hebrew and Greek and English, we have distinct relationships that separate these concepts, which allow them to unite in a proper order if we remember what they mean, if we know what they mean. That is, by inheritance, they will relate, but they have to be kept in their proper order. For instance, in Hebrew, the word goy, or goyim, which is the plural version of it, is a nation. It means an ethnic people. In Greek, it's real easy. Ethnos is the word for a nation. It's the same word that they translate goy or goyim into in Greek. And so in English, we understand this as a nation. We often see it in our Bible as Gentiles, but to make it understandable the way we speak today, it's nation. That's a direct translation of both the ethnos, the ethnic people, the goy of what's being referenced here. It's directly connected to one's ethnicity, one's nationality. Okay, those are synonyms, ethnicity and nationality, but they're not synonyms with the word country. They don't mean the same thing. Don't let somebody tell you that they do, because it distorts the meaning of what it's talking about, what the scriptures speak about. So within the speaking of one's nationality or ethnicity, it contains within its usage in the Bible, as the Bible uses the word, a subset, which is the next level, so to speak, of your father's house. You'll see those types of terminology. We'll see some scriptures that use it. Your father's house. And then it speaks of tribes. We may think of the next level as then families. And so you see subsets of the ethnic people. They are not distinct ethnicities, but in a sense they kind of are. After so much time has elapsed and so many generations elapse, one may call themselves by a particular family member that's 10 generations back, but yet they're from a larger nation. They're from one man and one man's family originally. Okay? And so in that understanding, we have tribes, and then we have kindred, and we have family, all of which speaks to the ethnos, the ethnic people of a nation, okay, that come from a father that we are to honor. That's the point. It all ties back to a father and a mother that we are to honor. And so when we look at the history of Israel, after the 40-year wilderness punishment, remember, God punished Israel because they didn't listen. They were not courageous and wouldn't take over the land, and so they got afraid and said, there's giants and we don't want to fight them. So they get punished for 40 years to wander around in the wilderness in the history of Israel. And that's after that, then we start reading things like Deuteronomy chapter 1, where we start reading about The way things were arranged and the way you're going to proceed in the land. We read about what we read about in Numbers chapter 1, the arrangement and the numbering of the people that and how they were going to move into the land and take over. But we also see laws in specifically Leviticus and Exodus. They are future in their scope. They're written immediately on Mount Sinai, but they don't get enacted entirely until the people take over the land. And so Leviticus and Exodus particularly are books that are future-minded. This is how it's going to be when you come into the land that I will give you. Okay? Whereas the other books are written almost from the perspective that this is when they were conquesting the land. It gives you the exact dates on which the books were written. The new moon of the 11th month, for instance, is what Deuteronomy tells us it was written in. It's important to notice that this people from the Egyptian Exodus and onward, we will read about them organizing themselves by the directed words of God. God will direct them. He will dictate law to them. And we've already covered the reason why that needed to be was because the Apostle Paul informs us that death reigned from Adam to Moses. So when Moses is dictated from God to him these words, and he gives them to the people, this puts a check against death. This stops the people's degradation of morality so that they can arrest death in a form and that they can be the kingdom of God. They can start to become what Exodus 19:6 says, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Okay? A nation, an ethnos that is holy unto the Lord. A kingdom that is like ministers that are priests of God. And so God Almighty himself directs the people to organize themselves before he gives them the Ten Commandments, to think of themselves as a kingdom of priests and a holy ethnic people, set apart for him. Okay? And so that comes right before the Ten Commandments are delivered from Mount Sinai, that little address in Exodus 19:6. That means that additional government at this time was being in place to check that death. Okay? Additional government was revealed. It doesn't mean it was added from the standpoint. When we talk about God, I think we stress this a lot. When you talk about God, who's an eternal God, same yesterday, today, and forever, we don't ever talk about God from the standpoint that God needed to make a change for us. God moves according to the dictates of his own will. What he decides to do all the way back and forever is what he does. He doesn't change for us. He doesn't need to. Okay? So when we speak of additional government, we're talking about that which was revealed in its understanding to man in the scope of what the fifth commandment was talking about. This is not to say that the Presbyterian order was not understood by a traditional construct. It's not to say that what they had, as we're going to see in the book of Exodus, that was already there by their traditional construct of family that Israel lived under, but rather that God is speaking at this time authoritatively to Israel, right? He's telling them exactly how he wants it and how he wants it arranged, as we've been kind of focusing on since we looked at the book of Titus, in revealing the more perfect government order of the kingdom of God, or what we call the kingdom of heaven, that has been lost up until this point. The check against death needed for the organization of the kingdom of God. And so what do we see that is that this is present? We see that a tradition like this is present in the Hebrew family government under the bondage of the Egyptians already. And so if we go to Exodus 3, where we'll start picking up and looking at a specific text where we get into this, laying some of that groundwork, we see that that there was already an order that the people would respect and understand. So I want to read it, and then we're going to break it down into some points and take a look at and consider how it says it. This is a very special moment in Israel's history and in the history of the world. This is where God, after many generations, is going to reveal himself to Moses. God wasn't invented then either. Okay? God revealed himself, trying to make a point. Though God was not known in certain ways, God revealed himself, and that's how he always was known to himself. God didn't change. And so in Exodus chapter 3, starting in verse 13, it says, "And Moses said unto God, When I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me unto you. And they shall say to me, What is his name? What should I say to them? You need to remember, Moses was not raised to know the name of God. He wasn't raised in a Hebrew home. He wasn't raised in an Israelite family. He was raised by Pharaoh, most powerful man in the world at the time. And he didn't know the name in the way that God expresses himself. And so God's not expressing himself by this specific name you pronounce a certain way, but it's by a certain force of power and meaning that he expresses himself. And so in verse 14, he says unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, Thus shall you say to the children of Israel, I am, hath sent me unto you. And God said moreover unto Moses, Thus shalt thou say to the children of Israel, Yahweh, which means he that is, I am that I am, is how God would say his name. That's who I am. I am that I am. So the idea of I am what I am is what he's expressing to them. There is no real name in a sense of what God is. We can't contain him in a name except for that's what it is. That's who he is. We don't even have words that talk about God. That's the best we can do is the self-existent God that expresses himself as that's what I am. And so when verse 15 speaks about it, you have to start noticing the order in which God speaks. So he says, Yahweh, God of your fathers, he that is. That's what Yahweh, that's how we talk about God. Yahweh means he that is in Hebrew. But how God would speak of himself is I am that I am. So Yahweh is he that is. He that is the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me unto you. This is my name forever. This is my memorial to all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say unto them, Yahweh, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Jacob, appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you and have seen that which is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the afflictions of Egypt, unto the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, unto a land, notice the word land, as we had been discussing borders and countries and all that stuff, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. 18, and they shall hearken to thy voice, and thou shalt come, thou and the elders of Israel, unto the king of Egypt, and they shall say unto him, Yahweh, God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and now let us go, we beseech thee, 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice unto Yahweh, our God. So notice that Yahweh speaks in certain orders in this particular part of the Bible, very important part of the Bible. Yahweh speaks by the value these people already have in their genealogical covenant of faith that's been given to their fathers, the memorial God. From this self-existent Lord God, who we call Yahweh, by the Hebrew term that expresses what he is, because he is what he is, whom Moses had little to do with so far. This is kind of his first meeting. Not his first meeting with his heart whenever he killed the Egyptian who was hurting his brother, and that might have been the first time God started to get his attention. But this is the first time he has God reveal himself to him. And here's some points that are listed out in this meeting. The first point I want to make is that the God of your fathers has sent me unto you. That is carried with it enough power to give Moses the ability to say, oh, what's your name? So I can go tell these people that you're the one that sent me. You know, the God of your fathers. That's how God describes himself. We'll get into that a little more in one of the next points. He then gives him the conceptual understanding of who he is in a name, what we would name God as. He that is, I am that I am, or Yahweh. Okay? I think Ahava is how you say I am that I am in Hebrew. Ahava. whereas Yahweh is Yahweh. Okay. And then he proclaims and he reveals this revelation as a memorial unto all generations. This is, to me, a very phenomenal, kind of phenomenal part of the Bible. Because in the third point I want to make is that he says, thus shalt thou say to the children of Israel, Yahweh, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever. This is my memorial to all generations. What does God do here? We speak of this in theological terms as God condescended himself. He brought himself down to man's level. Can you imagine God himself as the God of your fathers? Okay, that's how he brings himself down to your level. I think that that's pretty amazing stuff. So God condescends himself, the great I am, that truly has no name, not by anything we can comprehend. But the very fact that he is what he is, calls himself by the name of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Because in order to get to you, he needs to equate himself to make your human mentality understand what this means to you. He puts himself in covenant language and says, I am their God. I think that's kind of very amazing point of what's being said here, that God condescends himself by being the God of men. He brings himself down from being I am that I am, that's beyond comprehension, and makes himself the covenant-keeping God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And thus he links himself to this genetic or ethnic nation by a promise that these people inherited as being the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which we call the children of Israel. And so the fourth point that I'd like to make is, which is going to be a little longer in trying to understand it, because of the promise that God made to Abraham specifically, given to Isaac and given to Jacob, on account of the desire that didn't even start with Father Abraham, but with Father Terah, the father that's not even mentioned in this list, if we were to go to Genesis 11, Verse 31, we're told that the trip to Canaan that was specifically mentioned here as the land flowing with milk and honey that was going to become the country of the nation of Israel at this time for greater things in the future started with Terah, the father of Abram, who we call Abraham. And Terah took Abram, it says, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan, and they came unto Haran, and they dwelt there. And so we can see very clearly, I remember first time reading through Genesis and noticing this part of the Bible, that it was not Abraham who said, God, give me the land of Canaan. It was actually Terah, who God had not revealed himself to, who left Ur of the Chaldees with Abraham and set his face to go to the land of Canaan. It was his father who wanted to go to Canaan. For whatever reasons, we're not told. But Abraham pursues Canaan, and God appears to him. It's good to notice here, in talking about ancestry and inheritance and land and all this stuff, that Haran is the ancestral land of the Hebrew people. Haran is the actual home place before it was the land of Canaan, before we would think of Hebrews living in the land of Canaan. Hebrews lived in what we would call now Syria, or Aram, which is what the Bible in Hebrew calls it, in a place called Haran. That was the homeland of the Hebrew people at that time. This is the land, like I said, we call Syria, or in proper Aram. Haran was the inheritance of Abraham from his forefathers, prior to God promising him the land that flows with milk and honey in Canaan. It's for this reason, you should remember, that when we pray the prayer of the first fruits every Pentecost, before we eat our Pentecost meal, we recite before Yahweh, Assyrian, ready to perish, was my father, And he went down into Egypt, and he sojourned there with a few. And then what happened? And he became there a nation. That's what Deuteronomy 26, 5 through 11 says. I won't read all of it for this, but every Pentecost we read that, remembering where we came from, remembering that our father that we honor went to Egypt, Jacob, because of all that happened. And there, Jacob, the one man, and his children became a nation. It's an amazing statement. Abraham's folk were the Hebrews that lived in Haran of Syria. But they were living in Ur of the Chaldees. A common misconception is that Abraham was from Ur of the Chaldees. He wasn't. He was from Haran, as his father was. And when sons were born, the first forefather of this people who desired to go to Canaan was Terah, not Abraham. It was while in their original homeland, Terah, Abraham's father, dies, we're told in Genesis 11:32. And it's after this that Abraham is called to leave Haran, wherein his father's house and inheritance is. In Genesis 12:1-2, this is where the covenant-keeping God Yahweh, that is re-revealing himself unto Moses, telling Moses who he is, said to Abraham, "Come into the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will magnify your name, and you shall be blessed." And so this is what everyone was waiting for when Moses had this revelation, and he brings it to his people. What we see here is that Abraham, the Hebrew of Aram, Syria, living in what is called Haran, is the name that his brother, if you even look in the genealogies, Abraham's brother's name is Haran. And he journeys to the future inheritance of the children that he doesn't even have yet. And he's promised, "I'll give you land and I'm going to make you great and make you a nation." Abraham didn't have no kids when he had that promise given to him. No children. And he went anyway. And so the inheritance was for children he didn't have, that he left his father's home, his inheritance, his place of comfort in Haran, and he left to go to have a land given to him and a great mighty nation that he didn't have, children he didn't even have. And that's why we call Abraham the father of our faith, because he had a faith in the God who cannot lie that Titus 1:1-2 told us about very plainly in no uncertain terms. He left, he went to Canaan, a land already peopled with a strong society, people of another nation, nothing like the Hebrews. It's this place that God tells Abraham to go to. Kind of like if, you know, you think about it, God said it, "You're not just going to go to Canaan as your father Terah desired to go, but I'm going to give you children that you don't have yet. And I'm going to make this your ancestral homeland with the specific intention that would have all this built into it. We talked about in prior studies, the one seed of the woman from Genesis 3:15 was going to be born. The one seed of Abraham that the Apostle Paul says. He speaks not to many seeds, but to one, which is Christ. That's why seed is singular throughout the promises, though we oftentimes wonder, why did he singularize it? Why didn't he speak of a seed, many seeds? Abraham had many children, and Isaac had, you know, children, and Jacob had many children, many seeds. But the Apostle Paul says, this is said this way, specifically said this way, because there was one seed of focus that was going to be brought into the land for a very special purpose, and that purpose was going to be to crush the work of the serpent, according to Genesis 3:15. And so the story is encapsulated in Exodus 3:17, wherein Yahweh speaks just simply in saying, "I have said, I will bring you up out of your affliction from Egypt," which again was prophesied to Abraham, if you go back and read, in Genesis 15 through 17, this was prophesied to already happen in Egypt. But he says, "I will bring you up out of your affliction of Egypt unto the land of Canaan, are the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, unto a land that flows with milk and honey. And so he's speaking to a specific promise and covenant made with Abraham from God that the people would identify and know the time has come that God is raising us to the place that he promised to our father. It's kind of an important honor and respect that's given to our forefathers in the form of a covenant that we shouldn't forget. And so the fifth point I want to make is going to be what ties this specifically into what it is that we are talking about in the idea of church government. So notice to whom the message is then delivered in Exodus 3:18. And they, referring to the children of Israel of the prior verse, shall hearken to thy voice. And thou shalt come, thou and the elders of Israel. The elders of Israel. This message that God has come and has sent, that we've just discussed and elaborated on, that has sent Moses to proclaim that the time has come for this bunch of Hebrews to be a great nation, in fact, and to come into their own country. And that message was directed to the children of Israel. It's not proclaimed by a loudspeaker. Okay? Think about this. There was no loudspeakers back in these days. You couldn't go and speak to 600,000 men alone, is how many people left Egypt according to the Bible. How do you tell all these people? How do you tell them all it's time to go? How do you tell them all it's time for Passover? How do you tell them all anything? That's where the elders come into play. There was no loudspeaker. There definitely wasn't 600,000 leaflets printed on papyrus to distribute to the people. They weren't going to have leaflets to hand around so they could know what time to get going. No, Moses was directed to go to a group of old men. That's who he was told to go to, a group of old men that would understand this proclamation even better than their children. So he was going to go to a group of old men. He was going to proclaim this. They were going to tell their brothers. They were going to tell their sons and their daughters. They were going to tell their families of a lot of people. This is the representatives of the children of Israel. That's who he speaks to. Representatives of the children of Israel. These are the elders. That's to say, they're going to say this unto the king of Egypt. Yahweh, God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and now let us go. We beseech you, 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to Yahweh our God. That's the people who were going to carry the message with Moses. This family order was alive and well, is the point to make. Because even in a state of bondage, or most likely because of a state of bondage, it's the only thing you've got for a sojourning people bound in Egypt. We're told in Exodus 1:5 at the beginning of the book of Exodus, all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, referring to his children and his children's children that came down into Egypt. Exodus 1:5. These souls were then the foundation of this eldership that we're talking about. The 12 sons made 13, because Ephraim and Manasseh were separated and Joseph was no longer a tribe unto himself. So these 12 sons then made into 13 were the patriarchal heads of this people that then come to be 600,000 men alone. That needs government. There's no doubt about it. These 600,000 men still answered to the zakin, the old men in Hebrew. They still answered to the aged, ancient men of the tribe at this time. 600,000 people had to listen and value their father's advice enough to leave a whole country behind that they only knew for generations. Because of faith, because of the faith of a land that you haven't even seen that flows with milk and honey. And they had to believe it in March. These are the representatives of the children of Israel to whom Moses was commanded to go. They weren't the greatest, most elegant people, I'm sure. They were old men. That's what the scripture describes them as. And they were to go and proclaim the name of Yahweh to Pharaoh with Moses. The Greek Septuagint, the LXX, calls this group in Greek Gerosia. Generally, it's translated a council of elders or old men, because it's distinct from the word for presbyter when it's gathered together. There is a distinction in the Greek. Whereas in the Hebrew, on the other hand, it shows no distinction in the root words. It uses the same word, zekwin, which is often translated in the Septuagint as presbyter or the presbyters. As we've seen in Leviticus 19:32 already, where you'll both see the Hebrew word zekwin and you'll see the Greek word presbyter being used, presbyteron, where it commands that thou shalt rise up before the hoary head and honor the face of the old man, as we had read in the beginning of getting started in this. And that's how you fear your God, because I am Yahweh. And so you can see that the particular nation or ethnos, the ethnic kingdom, and how it has emerged and needed a form of government to talk to the people. It needed a representative form of government to talk to 600,000 people. You were never going to do it by a democracy. Okay? You were never going to do it by a loudspeaker because there wasn't one, and you weren't going to use a leaflet because you weren't going to print them in time. Okay? Not back in them days. So, do you see then how a nation or an ethnos, an ethnic kingdom, emerged from one Syrian Hebrew man and four wives of the same stock to come and make 12 patriarchal fathers of 600,000 men of the armies of Israel? And how this is an intrinsic form of government, meaning it builds itself. All it needs is organized by God's law. How a very natural and intrinsic family order based on the fifth commandment governs this people's direction to become a nation with a country, a land. In fact, it is the value of honor of the presbyters, it's the value of the honor of the presbyters, which is demanded by the fifth commandment, that keeps this host, this family army, moving in their covenantal future, in establishing a country by which they will understand the more full and revealed meaning of the church as it's bound up in the family structure, which is spoken of, as we had read in a past study of Ephesians 6:2-3, where we came to understand the mystery of the church and how, after that mystery is revealed by Paul to the Ephesians, he then quotes Deuteronomy 5:16. Honor your father and your mother, as Yahweh your God has commanded thee, that thy days may be prolonged, and that it may go well with thee in the land which Yahweh your God giveth thee. So you can, I hope at this point, start to notice how the inheritance in the land of your fathers is united to the nation and to the matriarchal order that brought you about. So I hope that everyone listens, particularly because I want to make it abundantly clear and start at this point in finishing what we're thinking about here to elaborate with these thoughts and tie up, not speaking deeply about it, not going very deep into it, but to just kind of contemplate at this time the theonomic, God's law, concept of a country, of a kingdom. But particularly understanding what that last clause means, in the land where Yahweh your God, or that Yahweh your God has given you, the land that he's given you, and the earth that you live in. And what was understood on Mount Sinai when they heard the Ten Commandments proclaimed and the fifth commandment was said, not only did they already understand the presbyterial order, did they understand that the elders were their fathers that were being spoken to, but what did this land that I give to you mean? In the country mentality and the idea of having a country that was your own, to the people on Mount Sinai, and saying that your days may be prolonged and that it may go well with you in the land which Yahweh your God gives to you. God's law speaks directly with the intrinsic element of land. And that's where we need to focus some of our thought on this ending here. Land, or the earth, or the soil is what is being spoken of in this commandment. And there is some very organic understandings that flow out of this that we have lost in our present day, poorly lost. Which in our English Bible, because when we think about it, many different words are translated from oftentimes one Hebrew word. And the one word used here in both Ten Commandments, both in Deuteronomy 5 and in Exodus 20, is Adamah. Adamah, you could find that in your Strong's Concordance under the Hebrew side H127. It is that which Adam was taken from, and it is that which is named after Adam. Adamah is named after Adam, not Adam from Adamah, as you can tell from the order of the addition of letters. But this speaks directly, when we talk about that, to his dominion over the earth that you would find in Genesis 1:26 through 28, that he was to have dominion over the earth. That was what we call the dominion mandate, which is throughout all the Adamah, or the soil, which is what's being spoken of the Eretz. That's the Hebrew word for earth. It's actually very similar to the English word for earth. It's Eret, Ereth, is the way we say it in English, but it's very similarly spelled in Hebrew. This is also the same word commonly used to speak of the borders of a country. Okay? That which the ethnic nation will inhabit. The land flowing with milk and honey is how we heard it spoken of in the covenant that was made to Abraham. And so the ethnic nation will inhabit a particular land that's being spoken of here in the fifth commandment, the land which they will fight for. Okay? A nation fights for its land. That's where we start to see the connection. They will fight to take it. They will fight to conquer, or conquest, we say, the land of Canaan. They will shed blood for it. Adam is derived from the word dam, which means blood. Okay? There's a very intrinsic meaning to shedding blood upon the earth to protect your land from which you were taken from. It binds the man to the earth. It possesses it, is what it does. There's a binding force that takes place when a man's willing to shed his blood for his soil. It's the soil which they will farm, and they will raise their children on the crops they produce from it. The family will be raised from the nutrition in the earth that is now thriving off the death and the blood that was spilt to protect it. There's a very harmonious understanding that is understood in the idea of a man that fights for his land that we have gravely lost in America today and in Europe. That soil which they farm, they raise their children on, which is the next generation and onward. The soil that they will build their homes in to make it a homeland, as we call it. That's what makes it a homeland, because you will anchor your home into the earth, into the soil that's under it. It'll be yours. The soil they will bury their dead in, and thereby fertilize the soil for the next generation. By the biblical axiom of thought that says, from dust thou art, into dust you will return. This soil is to be defended from foreign invasion by the rule of law for these reasons, because of these axioms, these truths of the way things work that are not hard to understand. The rule of law will favor the nation of common parentage, the ethnic people that dwell on it and will fight for it, who will grow in it and will thrive in it and make it their homeland. As well, in the biblical Israelite commonwealth, even the tribal subsets, if you think about the way the subsets of the people, tribes work, had specific ways that they had to function. As Americans would think of a state or a colony, that's what we're speaking of when we speak of a tribal territory. When we speak of a tribe, we're not just speaking about the people of the tribe. We're speaking about the country, the land that the tribe inherits. So, in a way, we think about the tribe of Zebulun as the people, but we also think of a border. We think of Judea or Judah as a land, but we also think of the people of Judah that live in it. So it creates a unity of people that protect their homeland. And as the best example, I think, still is what we would see that's closest to our modern day of people who have not lost this understanding, but have started to lose it all the more in our more modern times, would be the Scots. It's no differently when you go and look at a book on Scotland, whose land is hardly separable from the clans and septs. In their way of looking at it, a sept is the subset of a clan. So you have the clan, the bigger family, then you have the sept of smaller families that come out of it that have different names but are of the same clan, same way a tribe would work in Israel. And so there are still people that not too long ago thought of things in this way, which is probably about why Presbyterial government flourished in Scotland so well. That once these septs and clans once held in Scotland as a tribal possession, even the smaller tribal allotments, like the Israelite tribes, how they were banded together by theonomy, how they would sell their inheritance and not give it away, they were no differently. They defended their land and they died for it and they protected it and it was theirs. You didn't take it from them under for any purpose. There was no way you could separate the country from the people except for by war, except for by shedding of blood. And that was the only way that it was going to take place. And so it's no different under a theonomy. It actually was a form of theonomy in Scotland. So the inheritance of one's fathers in Israel should be known in something we call the Jubilee, which is, if you read all the laws, Leviticus 25 is where you'll find them, and 26 is where you'll start to see it. You'll notice that the Jubilee restricts how land can be treated. Land had to belong to the fathers of that land. It never could be sold. We did not set up America properly when we set up America because we constantly are swapping out land and moving all over the place, and we have no rule of law like this that we can even compare it to in America. But under Israel's law, under a theonomy that was set up properly, a 50-year lease or rent is all you could do. You could only disown your land for 50 years. Then after that, it had to come back to you. After this time, that's called the Jubilee, the tribal land and family land must be redeemed by its lawful and rightful owner, who was a prior owner. Okay, the lawful and rightful owner was the prior owner, the original owner related to the family. He was the inheritor of the prior owner's stuff if he was not the owner itself that sold it. That man had died in the 50-year period. Then his son or his direct blood relative, called a kinsman or kinsman redeemer, who was in all things the inheritor to the lease that was made. He inherited the lease, who made the 50 years or less contract originally. He inherited from that father the right to redeem the land. And so that's very much the way that the land is tied to the people, and it's not to ever be separated according to the theonomy of God's law. So why am I trying to point this out here is probably the question, because it seems like we're kind of stretching beyond in trying to explain this, and I want to make it clear before I close up. The reason I'm trying to explain this is that the land which Yahweh God giveth thee carries within it the honor of one's parents. It's a huge impact upon the national rationale of a people. There's a huge impact of thinking of nation and country and how it interacts with one another in relationship to the fifth commandment and as it's governed by the elders of the people, and how it would have been looked at in the Israelite theonomy. And how those of us who promote a Christian theonomy must look at this no differently and try to restore it at some future date. To understand father and mother is to understand parentage and patriarchy, that's why. And patriarchy, or the headship of one's father, which is what patriarchy means, has joined its very essence to that which we call patrimony, that which is inherited from one's father and from one's fatherland ultimately. And this is the fundamental stability of a country. This is what underlies the country, and this is what keeps a country stable. This connection to the dirt. That's where your bones are. Okay? That's where you farmed. That's where you built. That's where you defended. That's where your people died and bled for. That's what we're losing. That's what people don't care about. Okay? And that's why, for me at least, it kind of bothers me a little bit when people want to pretend like everything that happened in early America is useless to think about, because personally, we have blood in the ground and bones that are dust that defended this country against Indians and all kinds of other things that came against it. And so to just toss that to the wind is a huge disrespect to one's parents. Just pretend like that doesn't matter. And I think that that's very important to keep close to your heart and to think about and to remember where you come from. And so then the next question, I guess, is how does this relate to the next branch of church government past father and mother, the presbytery, that I think we laid a pretty good case for in the book of Exodus already. And the rule of the elders. Primarily, I think it's because the elder generation of a nation and a country, now that we understand that properly, are the fathers of the nation, for real. They are the real fathers of the nation. When you speak of one's fatherland, you're speaking of the land your fathers are from, not just speaking in abstract terminology. Okay, your motherland, there isn't, you know, that's maybe in the sense of the earth that provides for you or something like that, but whenever we speak of our fatherland, it's supposed to be in reference to the fathers that protect it and that died for it by war and by blood. And so I think primarily looking at the elder generation of a nation and coupling that with a country, with the country that we're from or the borders of our land, of a nation, and those who are godly beyond their age will preserve and guide the nation's next generations by reflection and honor of that people. The honor of children and the value in valuing their heritage and honoring their nation or their ethnic fathers will be a people who can then easily offer their life with ease of mind. You can probably just get rid of post-traumatic stress syndrome from the battlefield that so many soldiers deal with, because they don't know why they killed the people they killed. Now they got to live with the guilt of killing someone for not knowing why. In the case of defending your family, your nation, and your country, there is very little you have to bypass in the moral conscience to kill someone to protect your family and to protect your homeland. It's just natural. Every creature witnesses to it. And so with offering one's life on top of that, sacrificing yourself is an ease of mind when you're protecting and defending the Constitution of the Commonwealth of your people, because it is in fact one and the same as self-defense and self-preservation. It's the easy choice to make. Thus, to protect and expand one's borders is a family issue. It is a family enterprise. It is not just something that you do for money or for profit. So in the establishment of the first kingdom that was ordained, the theonomic Commonwealth of Israel under the leadership of Moses, the man of God, we see this focus becoming clearer to the people, I think, as they move out of Egypt while having within their family order the building blocks that are intrinsic and natural to all peoples, of all practical Adamic patriarchy are going to hold the same family order together. And then God moves that out into structuring it as a country. And so as we will see in the next Bible study, I'm going to try to tie this narrative of a nation and country into the election and the standards of the election of the presbytery that's revealed by Jethro, father-in-law of Moses, who reveals it to Moses. But he doesn't just reveal it to Moses. We're also told in Exodus chapter 17 that he revealed it also to the elders and Moses together. And that is where the eldership, the presbytery, and the bishopric start to come together, the episcopon that we had talked about in the book of Titus already. We'll start to unite at that point.
SS, Renewed Covenant Ministry.